Today is Tuesday, the 6th of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Afghan security personnel have been seen guarding Bagram Air Base.
Bagram had been where the U.S. military coordinated its air war and logistical support for its entire Afghan mission.
Plus, senior foreign executives of major telecommunications firms in Myanmar have been told not to leave the country. And how one woman is using her skills to empower and encourage young people to pursue careers in meteorology. We'll have these stories and more next. Afghan security personnel were seen guarding Bagram Air Base on Monday after American troops left their main military base in Afghanistan, marking a symbolic end to the longest war in U.S. history. The quiet departure from Bagram Air Base on Friday, July the 2nd, came as Taliban insurgents ramp up their offensives throughout the country after peace talks have stalled. Reuters' Emer McCarthy is up first.
Bagram had been where the U.S. military coordinated its air war and logistical support for its entire Afghan mission. And its quiet departure on Friday came as the Taliban insurgency ramped up its offensive, taking over multiple districts in the north of the country. More than 1,000 Afghan security personnel fled across the border into Tajikistan on Sunday, according to the Tajik Border Guard Service. The crossings underscore a rapidly deteriorating situation of escalating violence, just 2 days after the official withdrawal of foreign troops. Peace talks between the two sides remain inconclusive. Government sources told Reuters on Monday that Tajikistan is looking into setting up camps for potential refugees from Afghanistan. The Tajik Foreign Ministry, however, has declined to comment on whether the country plans to take in any Afghan citizens after being asked to do so by the United States, according to a published report. Washington has been looking for temporary accommodation for Afghans who have worked with U.S. forces and might face Taliban reprisals.
Emer McCarthy reports for Reuters News. Alex Younger is the former head of the British Secret Intelligence Service, which is also known as MI6. He told Sky News that the departure of the U.S. and NATO forces from Afghanistan could present a threat to allies.
The reality is that there are groups there. We've been very successful in disrupting both Daesh and Al-Qaeda. They're on the back foot, but it would be wrong patently to claim that they have gone away and they have the capacity to regenerate. If terrorist groups are allowed to regenerate somewhere like Afghanistan, it will lead to more threat on the shores of our country and our allies.
In a separate interview with Sky News, Lord Richard Dannatt, the former British chief of the General Staff between 2006 and 2009, said that while the original goal of removing Al-Qaeda from its training camps was quickly achieved by 2002, it was a mistake not investing in the future of Afghanistan. Dannatt says that moving forward, the people of Afghanistan will need to choose what kind of future they want, as the Taliban continue to make gains on the ground.
So this is genuinely going to be a civil war, an internal struggle. And it's up to the Afghan people to decide, do they want to go back under the Taliban or do they want to live that better life that we've shown them glimpses of? After all, women, children in education, position of women in society, much better. We've shown them a better life. It's up to the Afghan people now to fight for their better life or otherwise fall back under the Taliban. I think it's fair to say, and most independent observers would agree, we never went there with the intention of running that country for our own purposes. We went there with the intention of helping the Afghan people run their country in a better way so that that country could prosper and become part of the wider family of nations. The Russians, on the other hand, wanted to control Afghanistan for their own purposes. That was very different. Of course, the tragedy is that the outcome on the ground has been very similar. Extensive fighting right across the country. And for the Afghan people, this is an appalling prospect continuing. But I'm afraid, you know, we can't wave a magic wand and wish things to be different.
Tonight, Tarek Bitar, the judicial investigator probing last year's devastating explosion at Beirut's port, is seeking to file negligence charges against several Lebanese lawmakers and top security officials. He asked Parliament to lift the immunity of three of its members, former Finance Minister Ali Hassan Khalil, ex-Public Works Minister Ghazi Zaitar, and Nuhad Mashnouk, a former Interior Minister. The three men, he says, had been officially notified during their tenures that a vast cargo of ammonium nitrate had been unloaded at the port in 2014 and failed to take measures to reduce the risk of an explosion. Joe Macaron, a fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, discussed the Lebanese developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
This investigation has taken a long time. There were several top investigators that were changed. The process was not transparent. So what might come next? I think it was on the level of the ministers, but I think there's a higher executive leadership of the country that also bear responsibility of knowing what happened, especially in the last few months before the explosion. So I think we should wait and see how this investigation will move now to the next phase, dealing with public suspects, which are named, but knowing how the Lebanese system functions, knowing the state of the country at this stage, there's some skepticism, I think, while watching the process moving forward.
The U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said the U.S.'s expectation is that Lebanon's leaders show sufficient flexibility to form a government that is willing and capable of urgently implementing the necessary reforms to rescue the country's deteriorating economy. Is that feasible?
In principle, it's also feasible, but obviously there are many complicated aspects of the Lebanese collapse. First, there is the domestic rivalry, which is continuing now, especially between the president and the designated prime minister. Second, there's the aspect of unclear status of the U.S.-Iranian talks, and until we have clarity on this, also we might not see an urgency, especially by Iran to form the government. And also there's reluctance from the political class to form the government because they will have to face a growing list of demands and reforms, and they have to face this reality of collapse. Now there's no basically public accountability. There's no government in place to basically put all the blame on. There's a big power vacuum, and whoever gonna lead this government has collectively and individually to deal with this reality of collapse and enforce reforms that will not be popular, and also deal with the international community, whether with the IMF and the World Bank or other organizations. So I think we don't see the urgency, neither in Lebanon or abroad, to form the government.
Political instability in Lebanon is coupled with a deteriorating economy and living conditions amid soaring food prices, fuel and medicine shortages, and the Lebanese currency having lost 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar since 2019. What's the way out?
A couple of decades ago, whenever there's a crisis, the Lebanese relied on Gulf aid. Now this is not available. So the only way out is either to increase revenue, which is not foreseeable at this point, given how the country is not feasible now for investment, or to cut significantly the expenses, which also the political class is not willing to do, because this is how it serves their interests, basically to expand the bureaucracy, to employ their supporters. So it requires a very difficult decision. I think just negotiating with the IMF and getting more money to basically fund the same inefficient bureaucracy, it won't be a way out. There should be a clear shift of attitude, clear shift of mentality in how Lebanon sees the public sector. There's a cut in the electricity reforms and in the security sector, and the size of the bureaucracy in general. It's difficult to see a way out at this stage without a clear shift in the political class or in its attitude toward the state. But without a clear political process, a clear pressure from the international community and from the Lebanese to push the political class either out of the game or to advance a genuine process of political and economic reform.
That was the Arab Center's Joe Macaron speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Senior foreign executives of major telecommunications firms in Myanmar have been told by the junta that they must not leave the country without permission. Reuters reporter Libby Hogan has those details.
The confidential order was introduced in mid-June, said senior executives. Both foreigners and Myanmar nationals must seek authorization if they wish to set foot outside the country. Telecom businesses were also sent a second letter telling them they had until Monday, July 5th, to fully implement intercept technology that allows authorities to spy on calls. The spyware also tracks messages and web traffic. Reuters has not seen the orders, but spoke to someone with direct knowledge of the matter. The military did not respond to requests for comment. After seizing power in a coup in February, the military announced their aim to pass a cybersecurity bill. It also amended privacy laws to free security forces to intercept communications. The source said the travel ban on executives was meant to pressure telecoms to finish activating the spyware. Three other telecom sources, also speaking on condition of anonymity, said the authorities had stepped up pressure on the companies to implement the intercept, but declined to elaborate further.
Libby Hogan of Reuters News. Myanmar's ousted de facto civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi returned to a courtroom in the capital of Naypyidaw on Monday. Her appearance marked the start of a new round of hearings on corruption-related charges brought against her by the military junta that overthrew her government earlier this year. Lawyers have told reporters that they expect the current trial to last until the end of July. Moscow city officials say that early trials of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine among children between the ages of 12 and 17 have started in the Russian capital. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma is up next.
Moscow's deputy mayor says 100 young volunteers have been recruited who haven't been previously infected with the coronavirus and don't have health issues that would prevent them from getting the shots. The youths will receive a small dose of Sputnik V than what is usually administered for adults. The new trial comes as Russia faces a sharp surge in COVID-19 infections and is struggling to ramp up its low vaccine uptake. As of last week, only 23 million people, or just over 15% of the country's 146 million population, have received at least one shot of the vaccine. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
South Korea is in talks with mRNA vaccine makers to produce COVID-19 shots in the country and is ready to offer the capacity to make up to 1 billion doses immediately. Reuters' Olivia Chan has that part of the story.
The plan, if approved, would help ease tight global supply of COVID-19 vaccines, particularly in Asia, which lags behind North America and Europe in vaccine rollouts. It also puts South Korea a step closer to its ambition of becoming a major vaccine manufacturing center. This is Lee Kang-ho, the Director General for the Global Vaccine Hub Committee under South Korea's Health Ministry.
There are only a few mRNA vaccine developers: Pfizer, Moderna, CureVac, and BioNTech. Thus, there's a limit to how much they can produce to meet global demand. South Korea is keen to help by offering its facilities to produce them.
South Korea already has deals to locally produce three coronavirus vaccines developed by AstraZeneca, Novavax, and Russia. It also has a vaccine bottling and packaging deal with Moderna. Another government source said the local vaccine makers include Hemni Pharmaceuticals and Curatus. Hemni confirmed it has a big capacity reserved for a diabetes drug by pharmaceutical company Sanofi, which can be used for COVID-19 vaccine production as the project has stalled. The company's senior vice president Kim Soo-jin said Hemni has been reaching out to vaccine developers in the last year. Curatus, which makes a tuberculosis vaccine, said its new factory built last year can now be used for mRNA vaccine production. BioNTech declined to comment. Moderna and CureVac did not reply to Reuters' request for comments. A Pfizer spokesperson said the company is making efforts to enhance its COVID-19 vaccine supply chain. but added that they do not have specific announcements at this time.
Reuters reporter Olivia Chan. According to South Korea's Yonhap News Agency, the country recorded its third straight day of over 700 new coronavirus infections. The country had planned to allow fully vaccinated individuals to go maskless outside. But in the wake of these new infections, the mask mandate remains in place. According to the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency, over 80% of the newly recorded cases are in the Seoul metro area. An official said that the spread of the Delta variant, which was first detected in India, was also rapidly increasing, now accounting for some 7% of COVID-19 infections, up from less than 1% just 2 months ago. In North Korea, the country's coronavirus lockdown has taken a major toll on its economy. Its leader, Kim Jong-un, has hinted at a humanitarian crisis. Some fear the situation could get much worse. Bill Gallo has that part of the story.
North Korea may be the only nation to claim it is COVID-19 free. But even it now admits a worsening pandemic-related crisis. Last week, Kim Jong-un vaguely warned of a mysterious grave incident suggesting a major coronavirus lapse. He also recently acknowledged food shortages, comparing the situation to a devastating 1990s famine. Robert Lawler is with the Daily NK, a Seoul-based news outlet with sources in North Korea.
There's worries that there'll be another arduous march type of situation.
The arduous march refers to the period of mass starvation during the rule of Kim's father, the late Kim Jong-il, which may have killed millions. It's impossible to say how bad the situation is now. There are no signs of mass starvation. But Lawler says the prices of food and certain luxury items from China have skyrocketed amid North Korea's toughest in the world lockdown.
People are hurting because of the closure of the border, because of the poor harvest last year. Because your movements are restricted, people on, particularly in the border region with China, aren't able to conduct their business activities, official or non-official.
Despite the crisis, North Korea isn't showing urgency on coronavirus vaccines. VOA has learned Pyongyang hasn't even completed all the paperwork to get vaccines from COVAX, a UN-backed vaccine-sharing initiative aimed at assisting low- and middle-income countries. It's not clear North Korea has vaccines from anywhere else either, puzzling observers like Yang Mu Chin. Yang says he doesn't know why North Korea has refused vaccines, adding North Korea isn't known to have any particular aversion to them, like some do in the West. North Korea's basic predicament is that it wants to keep the border closed to protect from the virus, but must open it in order to get vaccines. It's a situation that may not threaten Kim's rule, but will get riskier the longer it lasts. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Rescuers have resumed the search for survivors at a Florida condo building that was demolished on Sunday evening. Three more people were recovered on Monday, bringing the death toll to at least 27. Associated Press correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
Now that the condo building has been brought down, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis says there are newly accessible areas, including master bedrooms.
The identifications will be able to accelerate now that they have access to that because of it had been inaccessible. And then because there were likely a lot of people who were sleeping at that time, unfortunately, in that part of it.
And there's good news on the weather front. Tropical Storm Elsa is heading west of Surfside.
The impacts here should be incredibly, incredibly minimal. May get some rain. You may get a little bit of wind, but nothing like we were looking at maybe a couple days ago.
I'm Shelley Adler.
Local officials said on Monday that armed kidnappers took 140 students from their boarding school in northwestern Nigeria. Attackers opened fire on the Bethel Baptist High School in Kaduna State early on Monday, abducting most of the 165 pupils boarding there overnight. Teachers at the school told reporters they don't know where the students were taken. Police in Kaduna State say they have rescued at least 26 people, including one teacher. Monday's abduction is one of the many recent kidnappings, usually for ransom, that have hit schools in northern Nigeria. Hackers suspected of being behind a massive ransomware attack have made a demand of $70 million in cryptocurrency in exchange for unlocking all of the affected systems. The demand appeared on Sunday on a dark website used by the Russia-linked Revol gang. The cyber attack Friday hit the systems of hundreds of companies and public agencies across the world. It involved a breach at the Miami-based software company Kaseya, which called the attack sophisticated. Kaseya said in a statement that it had a detection tool available for customers to see if their systems were infiltrated and that it hoped to begin bringing its data centers back online by the end of Monday. The FBI said Revol was responsible for a late May ransomware attack that shut down the operations of JBS, the world's largest meat processing company. Rescuers in Japan are continuing their search for 80 people still missing after a landslide in the city of Atami. Some 1,500 people are involved in the rescue efforts. Japanese broadcaster NHK said that two people were found alive on Monday and that the official death toll from the incident is 4. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Australia is facing a smaller and older population as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. That's according to a landmark government study that's published every 5 years. Phil Mercer has the details.
The fifth intergenerational report is forecasting slower population growth in Australia due to falling levels of immigration and a sharp decline in the fertility rate. The reports are published every 5 years. They forecast the outlooks for the economy and the budget over the next 4 decades. Modelling has suggested that the economic legacy of the COVID-19 pandemic is going to be felt for many years to come. It's highlighted the ballooning costs of healthcare as the population ages. By 2060, there'll be just 2.7 people of working age for every person aged over 65 in Australia, compared to the current level of 4 people, which puts a greater strain on public finances. The taxes of working-age people help to support the essential services for a growing cohort of older Australians. The government has said its challenge was to fund aged care services while maintaining a sustainable tax burden on workers. Australian Treasurer Josh Frydenberg.
What this fifth intergenerational report does show is that the Australian economy continues to grow, that we have debt increasing, but it remains sustainable and low by international standards, but that we do have a major challenge ahead of us, namely in the ageing of the population, the longer term impacts of COVID, and the need for Australia to boost productivity.
25 million people live in Australia. The fifth intergenerational report has predicted that number will grow to about 39 million by 2060, which is less than previous estimates. It's the first time that long-term population projections have been revised downwards. It means the Australian economy will be smaller and the community will be older than previously anticipated. Migration has boosted economic growth and can reduce the impact of an ageing population. But Australia closed its international borders in March 2020 to curb the spread of COVID-19, and immigration has all but stopped. Even when travel restrictions are eased, the government says migration levels will take years to recover. Girls born in Australia between 2017 and 2019 can expect to live 85 years, or about 4 years longer than boys. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And finally, in Accra, Ghana, Maureen Ahiataku is part of a new breed of young meteorologists that are using their skills to empower and encourage young people to pursue careers in meteorology. For more perspective, Africa 54's technology correspondent Paul Ndiho spoke to Maureen, a meteorologist with the Ghana Meteorological Agency, via Skype.
How did you become the weather lady?
I'm a meteorologist by profession. And when I was young, I had a passion to know more about the atmosphere, especially with the term of when you play ampe, that's a local game in our tradition, in the night, you get stuck into the atmosphere. So I think that is where the passion all began from. So from my primary to senior high education, I proceeded to the university to pursue meteorology in climate science at the University of Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology in Kumasi, that is in Ghana. From there, I graduated and I got the opportunity again to work with this institution, and I had the opportunity again to travel for my further studies outside Ghana, and that was in Ewha Women's University in South Korea, in Seoul. So I had the opportunity again to study atmospheric science and engineering. I still work with the Ghana Meteorological Agency as a meteorologist. Before I travel, I was a forecaster, and I predict the weather. Then later on, after the studies, I've now moved into the hydro meteorology unit, mainly for research work.
When you're doing your weather forecast, what are some of the things that you look at?
We look at first, you need to know the season in which you are. That's one key thing you need to know. Then we use the satellite products. We use the models. Also, we run our local models here. We also use that. And then you need to use the observation from the station. So those are local observation in terms of information from your area, ground truth observation. This helps you to validate what the models and then the satellite informations are saying regards to your area of consideration or area of study. So you also look out for the moisture, so that's the relative humidity. And we look out for the energy in the atmosphere, that's the CAPE, also tend to see whether the energy in the atmosphere is enough when we have the heating or insulation.
When you talk to your friends, when you interact with the people who don't know about the weather, what are some of the things what kind of questions are people asking you?
Yeah, mostly that is the question. The moment you mention, oh, I'm a meteorologist or I work with the weather institution, everybody will just want to know, okay, will it rain today or will it not rain? And or what will be the weather for in the few days? That these are some of the questions that they will pose to you to know whether it will rain or not.
A lot of people talk about climate change in Ghana, where you are. When you go to northern Ghana, that place is always very, very hot. Even in areas of Accra, I've been in Accra like around May, and it was very, very hot. I just barely, stay outside. So what role do you play when it comes to maybe telling your friends about climate change?
On a weekly basis, the forecasters come up with the forecasts. So PEMA unit, which is more of hydrometeorology, we collect more of the rainfall information across the country, try to analyze this to see whether the forecast that was given, how it performed over the various areas. So we process this into a mouth of visualized data for the forecasters to use. Aside that too, we run models to see how these rainfall patterns will be in the weeks ahead of time. So we also give this also to the forecasters to use in conjunction with the other satellite products as well. Also, we undertake research to find out, as you know, climate change, a lot of people, well, especially with the high impact in terms of flood that we are getting, people are being affected. So a lot of people will be like, is it the heavy rainfalls that we are getting that is causing this flood? So we undertake a research to see whether these floods are actually meteorologically induced or are they are from human activities. And this study is online as we undertake meteorological analysis of flood within Ghana. We look at two cities and we've realized that currently the storms that track over our regions, naturally, yes, some of them produce heavy rainfall, but most of the flood that we are experiencing are due to human impacts. Like we have choked drag gutters, less drainage systems are not even there. Now, a lot of places are being paved, so the water is not even able to percolate well into the soil, so they run off causing floods around.
Well, Maureen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. be well, be safe, and have a great day.